Good morning. So let's do a quick wake-up call. Who of you here uses Wi-Fi? Okay, great. Everybody's awake? Well, almost everybody. So Wi-Fi, I mean, if you're building anything using Wi-Fi, you know that it's this opaque thing where you just, it's one of the things where you have a chip handling everything and abstracting all the complexities away from you. So on the one hand, that's kind of cool because you don't have to deal with all the complexities. On the other hand, for us as hackers, it's not so cool because we don't know all the complexities and we don't know how it's working. So that's why we have Daniel here, who knows all the insides and outsides of Wi-Fi and the Wi-Fi chips, and is going to tell us more about this now. Have fun.
Thanks for the introduction. Thanks for showing up, everybody. So I will talk about how does a Wi-Fi chip work internally. And as the introduction said already, so why is this interesting? For most of us, we just have a notebook which maybe has a Wi-Fi chip already integrated. And usually we just know that somehow signals go in. And on the other hand, on the other side, internet comes out if we are lucky. And but still, like, what is in between? What is this black box of a Wi-Fi chip? What is happening in there? And yeah, so this is what I want to talk about today. Before going deeper into this topic, I just want to quickly talk about the history of Wi-Fi and how does this even come into existence. And it all started with AlohaNet, which was introduced by the University of Hawaii. And they had the problem back in the 70s, so 1970, they had a mainframe on the sort of main island, which they had different terminals on like smaller islands around it, and they wanted to have all the terminals connect to this one mainframe. And they thought, okay, let's use wireless technologies for this. And so they decided to have like one frequency to send data from the mainframe to all the terminals, and another frequency to send the data back from the terminals to the mainframe. So this sounds well and good on first glance, but it turns out that you have a problem when two terminals want to send at the same time. And this was the first time they encountered basically collisions, and they needed to solve this somehow. And so this was basically the first time they encountered this problem. And so in the first stage, they tried to solve it just by thinking, maybe I don't need really to have a 100% reliant way of sending data to the mainframe and back. Maybe it's good enough to just say, I need some kind of acknowledgement that eventually it gets through, but maybe I don't need to send it when I want to send the data. If it's okay, if it doesn't get acknowledged immediately, I just resend it over and over again till eventually it will arrive and I get an acknowledgement back, and then I know, okay, it has arrived, I can send the next data. And so basically they came up with this concept of acknowledgements, and this way they could solve, at least in a rough way, this issue with two people sending at the same time. And later on they also introduced like time slots and more fancy channel access methods, but in the first stage they came up with this acknowledgement method. So here I just try to summarize like which types of Wi-Fi standards there are. So they all start with 802.11, and they are defined by the IEEE. The IEEE is a sort of association of professionals who define these standards. And as you can see, it's pretty old already. Like the first one here I mentioned is 1999, but there are even older ones. And then, so there is like, this is from the nomenclature, they always have this 802.11, and then there is like this letter at the end. And at some point they decided to have one letter is not enough, so we need two. And then at the later point in time, they even said, okay, let's screw all of these. Let's just call it a generation name so that we can just increase the number. And then it's easier for people to, when they buy routers, they just want to buy the one with the highest number, sort of. So Yeah, that's that. So how does this Wi-Fi chip look on the inside, like when we look at a block diagram? So from the right-hand side to the left-hand side, we have a few components. So we first start with the antenna, and then we have the radio, which is really the hardware, which is turning the wireless signals into bits. And then we have the physical layer, which turns the bits into actual data, which we can process. And then we have a real-time core in this case, which does all the time-critical calculations. And then we have what I call just a Wi-Fi core here. This could be an ARM processor or anything else. And then in this case, I said, okay, we have a PCIe core, which does the connection to the rest of the notebook, basically. And all of these cores are connected via some interconnect. For ARM, it could be some AMBA standard like AXI or APB, but there are different technologies. It's also important to mention that this real-time core, there are different types of Wi-Fi chips. So I decided to, so for Broadcom, which I will explain later on a bit deeper, they use such a real-time core to do these fast calculations. So this is a separate core, really. But there are other designs which, for example, just have a second core from an ARM just dedicated for this real-time stuff. And then more cores are used for the MAC layer. So overall, this is a full MAC chip. So this means that the MAC layer of Wi-Fi is calculated within the Wi-Fi chip itself. So in comparison to this, there are also soft MAC chips. And in the soft MAC chips, the calculation of the MAC layer is done on the host, basically on the notebook itself, on the driver. But the majority of chips, in my opinion, are full MAC chips. So at least in smartphones and integrated stuff which you have in your notebook is usually a full MAC chip. So, and then in this talk, I will go deeper into those four blocks. So we start with the radio and the antenna, and then we will go into how does the physical layer work, what needs to be done in the real-time core, and we briefly discuss what's happening in the MAC layer. So let's first discuss the antenna. And for this, we need to introduce the concepts of wavelength. So basically, what I wanted to get to is how do we even know how long does an antenna need to be? And usually, we in like older routers, we just have these sort of like a monopole like type antennas, which are just some kind of metal rod, basically. And what we could do is we can use this frequency here to calculate the length of this by calculating the wavelength which we want to receive, basically. And the wavelengths can be calculated by taking the time for the light speed of light, basically, dividing by the frequency which we want to receive. In this case, so at Wi-Fi 2.4 gigahertz and Wi-Fi at channel 6, we can calculate, okay, this is roughly 12 centimeters. And now we also need to know that the antenna is usually half or a quarter of the wavelength. And then it makes sense, right? So like 6 centimeters is around this. And if we have like an older Wi-Fi router, something like this, this is roughly 6 centimeters, so it makes sense. And even for integrated Wi-Fi chips in the notebook, these are usually they're sometimes using PCB antennas, but it's the same concept. So they could use maybe just a quarter of the wavelength. It would be 3 centimeters. Then this could be easily done on a PCB. And one more thing which is important to mention is the antenna orientation is also important. So as you can see here in this diagram, this is basically like inside of this donut, there is this monopole antenna which sticks out like this. And you can see the power is mainly going horizontally, so and not vertically. So it's important to basically have sender and receiver on the same orientation for the best reception. Okay, so now that we know a little bit about the antenna, how does these signals even look like? So I just wanted to give a rough idea here. And so here I have a cosine, basically a function, which has some kind of amplitude and which changes like this over time. And what I can do is, so in general, you can look at this sort of signal in two ways. You can look at it from a time domain, and you can look at it from a frequency domain. And if you have a perfect cosine, then in the time domain, you would have just a single point of a frequency in the frequency domain. So as you can see here, the x-axis is here frequency instead of time. And basically what this shows is that this signal just consists of a single frequency. In reality, Wi-Fi consists of many frequencies. I mean, it would look more like a bell shape or something like this, because like you have all these different frequencies which your complete signal consists of. But this is just for simplification. And it's also important to mention that we can use the fast Fourier transformation to get from the time domain to the frequency domain, and the inverse of that, so the inverse fast Fourier transformation back from the frequency domain to the time domain. And if we use the correct parameters, we can do this lossless. So either way, each direction we go, it's not a problem. We can do the transformation lossless usually, so without using any information. So what ways are there to encode data in such signals? So how can I manipulate them to show a difference between 0 and 1, right? So there are mainly three ways to do this. So one could say I just change the frequency by sort of changing the width of this cosine I showed earlier. I can also change the amplitude of this cosine. And what is a bit sort of counterintuitive is like I can change the phase. So as we saw before, this cosine changes over time, so it has a sort of a cycle. And depending on when I start this cycle, for example, here I just flip it basically, and instead of sending at this point in time here in the middle line, instead of just sending it the same signal again, I can basically flip the orientation of this and send it again. And this is called like changing the phase. And for Wi-Fi, we mainly look into those two, so the amplitude and the phase change. So one more slide to make this a bit more, to show this a bit more. So here in this first example, I used phase modulation to encode a zero, and then, as before, I flipped it basically to encode a one, and then I went back, flipped it again to encode a zero, and then again a zero, nothing changed. So this is basically the phase modulation, and for the amplitude modulation, what I did here is just I do not send anything when I want to send a zero, and when I want to send a one, I just send with some kind of frequency. I can also like just do a lower amplitude and a higher amplitude to make the difference between a zero and a one. So this is just an example. Okay, the next important concept which we need to understand is the IQ constellation diagram. And I already told you for Wi-Fi we need both the amplitude and the phase of the signal. And in an IQ diagram, unfortunately, what we cannot do is just say, like one axis is the amplitude and the other axis is the phase. This is not how it works. We just need to, like there is a lot of math which we can look into, but for now we can just say, okay, an amplitude and a phase somehow describes a point in this IQ diagram. And I can get to this point by using the amplitude as the length of this vector here. And they can use the phase to sort of from the positive axis here to go counterclockwise to say, okay, how far does this or how far do I need to get with this vector? And then if I have these two pieces of information, I can basically create this cross inside this IQ diagram. And this will be very important, as we will see briefly. So with this in mind already, I can try to encode data. So here, for example, I just said, OK, at the left-hand upper corner here is 0, 0, then the right-hand side is 0, 1, and then and same for the bottom. So I can already encode like 2 bits with one cross, sort of. And this is already a modulation scheme. So here this is called QPSK, because I only use the phase here in this example. I don't change the amplitude. So if you can maybe hopefully see it. So this is all the length of this vector should always be the same. So what you can also do, you can even use more crosses in this diagram to encode more bits at the same time. But then you need to also modify the amplitude. Okay, so maybe you have seen a diagram like this at some point in time. So I want to explain how OFDM works. OFDM stands for orthogonal frequency division multiplexing, and this is very important because we want to send not only we want to use the amplitude of and the phase of a single frequency. We want to change the amplitude of in the phase of many frequencies at the same time, and the frequency should be as close as possible. But now you may think, okay, but usually at Wi-Fi at 2.4 gigahertz, I can only use like three channels. So there are 11 channels in total, but everybody says I can just use channel 1, channel 6, and channel 11 usually, and I should not overlap them. So how does this work? I'm saying that we want to use many frequencies at the same time. And this is the trick of OFDM, and how this actually works is that we use what they call subcarriers, and the subcarrier is a different frequency. And so basically what you can see here, all these different frequencies, this is what you, for example, can see in your router. So sometimes your router tells you which neighboring access points there are and which channel is best for you to choose for your access point. And it could look like this, that you have like some neighbors which send on channel 1 and 6 and 11, and you can try to figure out which one has the lowest reception for to set the channel appropriately for your router. But what I want to tell is basically one of these envelopes here consists of many frequencies, actually. It's not a single frequency, it's many frequencies. And they don't call them frequencies, they call them subcarriers. And we want to space them as close as possible. And in a case of 802.11a, we have 52 subcarriers in total. 48 of them are used for data, and 4 are used for pilot signals. And this is used for synchronization. But how can we actually basically get those frequencies so close to each other? And the trick is, when one frequency is at its peak power, we try to map the next frequency so that basically it's close to zero. And because we are on this is basically one device only, we can do this spacing very carefully, and therefore they do not interfere with each other. And we can still basically use amplitude and phase modulation for each of these frequencies. And that's how we get to these huge data rates in Wi-Fi. So we have many frequencies, and for each of these frequencies, we change the amplitude and the phase. So I hope this makes sense. So this was the frequency domain, as I explained earlier. And in reality, like if we do the IFFT in the time domain, it would look like this. So it's like a very strange sort of signal, because it's all summed up and mixed together. And that's why it looks like this. But with this carefully spacing of these frequencies, we can still figure out on the receiver side how the amplitude and the phase for each of these frequencies look like. Okay, with all this in mind, we can already try to calculate how does, for example, one come to 55 megabit per second. So In all the Wi-Fi standards, the routers always promised us to have 55 megabits per second. So how was this even calculated? So this was like never achieved in reality. You have like more like 20 megabits or so. And but still, this is basically what they advertise their routers with. And the data rate is calculated by this formula, and all we do is basically use the bits per symbol. So basically, how many bits is one cross in this IQ diagram, and then the number of subcarriers, so the number of frequencies, and we divide that by the duration it takes for one of these crosses to be transmitted. So in a previous example, I had like one cross was 2 bits. But here in this case, we have 64 QAM, which means I have 64 different crosses which I can use to encode bits. This means one cross can have 6 bits worth of information. And if I use this to and multiply it by the number of subcarriers, so I just told you it's 48 for this Wi-Fi standard, and we divide it by the time it takes to send this, so this is 4 microseconds, in this case, we get to 72 megabits. And now we also need to take care of the encoding. Encoding in this case means forward error correction. So in this case, I need to investigate 4 bits to send 3. So this means I need to 1/4 of this what we just calculated, I need to throw away, basically. And this is how you get to 54 megabits per second. OK. So now we can have a deeper look into how these building blocks I mentioned earlier actually work. So at the first step, this is the radio. And it consists of mainly these of like 4 major components. So after the antenna, we usually have an amplifier. And this amplifier just brings up the amplitude of the signal so that we can have an easier time to read it and decode it. And then we actually split up the signal into 2 parallel paths. So one is for I and one is for Q. And at the end of this, we have what we need to make our crosses in this IQ diagram and to get back from the cross to the actual bits. And that's why this IQ constellation diagram is so important, because everything comes back to IQ, basically. And to get the separation for I and Q, and the next step, we have this mixer. And this mixer usually does a down conversion from 2.4 gigahertz to something close to zero, because if we are close to zero, our analog to digital converters can be very cheap. And we can also, at the same time, when we do this mixing, we can also do the split up between the I and Q part of the signal. Then the next phase would be a filter, usually. So in this case, a bandpass filter just gets rid of anything which we don't want in our signal. And then the last step is this analog to digital converter, which does actually a sampling. So somehow we need a way to get from our analog signal to a digital representation. And this is done by sampling. And sampling means we have a certain period in time where we look at the waveform and we note down the value for this. And this is how we try to roughly get to the values which are actually used in the analog waveform. And so the question is, how often do I basically need to do this sampling? And for this, there is the Nyquist theorem. And this says I need at least twice the bandwidth, my sample rate needs to be twice the bandwidth. So in this case, usually in Wi-Fi, you have like 20 mega, or like in all the Wi-Fi standards, you have like 20 megahertz wide signal. And then because we split it up, we only have like 10 megahertz on each side here. And this means we need at least 20 megahertz sampling rate for in each ADC here. Okay, so this is all well and good in theory, but is this also the reality? And here in the next slide, I brought a sort of scary looking data sheet from a software-defined radio from analog devices. But if we sort of try to blend out all the unimportant stuff, we can see that actually, yes, this is how it works in reality. So at the beginning, we have our low noise amplifier, which is just brings up the signal I mentioned earlier. And then there are these two paths again for I and Q. And then there is the mixer, which brings down the signal from 2.4 gigahertz to zero megahertz. And then we have some bandpass filtering or some kind of filtering. And then we do our analog to digital conversion. And then there are like additional steps here, but this is because it's a software-defined radio. A software-defined radio is usually has the advantage that it's not only receiving on a single frequency, but it has a wide range of frequencies which you can receive and probably also send. And that's why we need this additional stuff. But in general, the rough components I showed you earlier, this is also how it works in the reality. And another example I have is here from a Broadcom chip. So this is from Broadcom was first sold to Cypress, and now it's owned by Infineon. And it's nowadays the names of the chips have changed in the past, but this is like a 4339 original Broadcom chip. And in this case, they have. It looks similar to what we just discussed. So we have like the low noise amplifiers at the beginning. We have a mixer. We have the filtering and the analog to digital conversion. They just don't show you the both IQ path. They just assume that you know, okay, from this point on, it's basically two parallel paths. And the path which is shown below here, this is a dedicated path for 5 gigahertz. So here the top path is basically used or shared between Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, and then the below path is only for 5 gigahertz Wi-Fi. Okay, so much for the radio. As I said, at the end of this, we have IQ signals, but we still don't have like these are already bits, but we don't have like the actual knowledge what these bits mean. And this is what's going to happen in the next stage. This is what's going to be decoded in the physical layer. So the steps in the physical layer are usually those five building blocks. So and they are the same for receiving and sending, of course. It's just that the direction is, or like the order of which in which stuff is done is different. So for, I will talk about the receiving path here only. So for receiving, the first thing we need to do is we need to have this sort of a frame detection and synchronization. So where does our frame even start? After this, we need to get from the time representation to a frequency representation. After this, we have a demapper, which basically looks up the where is this cross in our IQ diagram and which kind of bit is this. And then we do, which I call decoding here, which is basically the forward error correction. And then we need to descramble it. So these are the basic blocks, and now we go into we will explore them in a greater detail in the upcoming slides. But first, we need to introduce an additional concept, which are called multipath effects. So this is important for the frame detection and synchronization. So if you imagine you have a sender and a receiver, the signal could maybe propagate straight from the sender to the receiver. But let's say there is like a wall just in close proximity here, then this signal can actually bounce from this wall and get received by the receiver a second time. And this is a problem which we need to solve. And this is called basically multipath effects, because you receive the signal more or less twice, but like sort of on different points in time and slightly different points in time. And this is what I tried to show here. So basically the first line would be like the direct line, and the second line would be the indirect line bouncing off from the wall. And what we do against this this interference is we basically duplicate some piece of information in this signal. So here we this is called the guard interval, and this is basically copied from the end of the symbol into the front. And this is also called a cyclic prefix. And then, so basically this, all of this here is one symbol, and then here there would be the next one. And the problem comes up when I try to, so here I'm basically, at this point in time, I'm already done with receiving the first symbol, and I want to receive the second symbol, but now I have this sort of overlap still from the first symbol, and I don't know what it's like. Is this like, does this piece of information come from symbol two or symbol one? And this is where I have the actual problem. So you may also think, okay, but isn't it also a problem that symbol one is received twice here? Is this not also some kind of interference? And you would be right. But we can, it's basically because this is the same information, it's not that bad. It's just bad because like this is actual, it could be two different pieces of information, and I need to sort of distinguish them. And what I can do is, okay, now that I want to actually receive symbol two without receiving symbol one, I just discard this whole block here, and then but I still have all of the information from symbol two, because I now I have the same situation as the beginning. I just have all of symbol two, and then here it's also symbol two. So this is how I can basically try to figure out what is which symbol in, without having too much interference between symbols. Okay, apart from that, we also have a so-called preamble at the beginning of a symbol. So this preamble consists of a short training field and a long training field. And what is called the actual symbol piece of data here. What the symbol does is it just encodes the modulation and the coding scheme for the actual data. So this means basically the whole piece at the front of before the data is always encoded in the same data rate. So you maybe know that depending on the reception of your signal and how good or bad your reception is, the data rate changes, right? So you could have a very good reception with a high data rate, and this is how it's actually done. So you basically encode how you figure out how good the channel is, and then you encode the data rate of the modulation scheme and so on in this symbol field, and then you can, you know, okay, for upcoming data I need to use the this and that encoding scheme, and this also means that this part in the front of here, this is always encoded the same, so this does not change. And then so what does this short training field and long training field actually do? So this is basically the sender is using known magnitudes, so basically amplitudes and phases, and basically encodes data with this, and then the receiver can check this and can say, okay, I know it should look like this, but it actually looks like this, and then I can try to use the difference between these two informations to add this as a sort of correction data to the rest of it, and this is called equalization. And this is what we need to do because, for example, here we had these two symbols at the same time sent, and with this equalization, we can figure out what the difference or like which kind of interferences we have, and we can use this these pieces of information to correct the data which is sent afterwards. So from an IQ perspective, this looks like this. So maybe the receiver has like some kinds of symbols which are all over the place, but he needs to know exactly where they are, and he can basically use the equalization data to say, okay, these crosses actually need to be here or here, and then do the decoding afterwards and correct the errors which happened during transmission. Okay, so after frame detection and synchronization, we can do the next step. So here at the bottom right, I always try to show where we currently are. So next step is the fast Fourier transformation. So as I said at the beginning, we can basically go back and forth from time to frequency And this is what is done here. So for sending, I always need to be at the time domain, but for decoding, I want to go to the frequency domain. And here in this case, I just have basically different frequencies, and they all have the same amplitude, but they could have different amplitudes. And then I can use this basically to create my crosses in this IQ diagram. And then I can, depending on where the cross is, I can go back to my bits. And this is basically called demapping. Okay, so what happens in case of errors? So let's say I have an like even simpler example. Instead of like having four crosses, I only have like two crosses. Left hand side is a zero, right hand side is a one. And but still, maybe I have like a really bad channel, and it turns out that one cross, which is supposed to be a zero, moves over this sort of barrier and is now interpreted as a one. So can I somehow still decode this or figure out that has something gone wrong? And so what we could think of as an example is, okay, let's say I have four bits, and the fifth one would be a parity bit. Doesn't matter how it's calculated, but we know when this is sent and we receive this, and we calculate the parity from these four bits we have received, we know that the parity is bad. Okay, somewhere needs to be an error. But how do we even know where the error is? Okay, I just highlighted it here, but we need sort of an automated fashion to figure out which of the bits is bad, basically, because we can send multiple bits at the same time, because one cross is worth multiple bits. And what's actually being done is, instead of just saying, okay, like this, I just do a binary sort of decision in this case, is this a one or a zero, I can basically try to provide probabilities to these. So here in this case, this one, I was pretty sure that this is a one, so it was like a 0.98. For this zero, I'm pretty sure it's a zero because like the actual value was like 0.02. But for this one, this was just like barely over the line. It was just 0.52. So this is sort of suspicious, and the next one is still like pretty good. So if I have a parity error and I have like this additional information of like how like good this this demapping was, then I can say, okay, if I only have like one suspicious bit in here, it's most likely that the error was here, and then I can just basically flip the bit, and the parity should be good again. And this is called a soft demapping, because like you don't do this hard decision between a zero and a one, you have additional information based on these probabilities, or sort of probabilities. And for this, an algorithm which is called Viterbi is often used, but this is all it does, basically. Okay, the last step which we need to look at is descrambling. The sender needs to scramble the data to avoid even numbers of zeros and ones. We want to avoid this because we want to spread the power across the spectrum evenly, if possible. So we don't want to like just have one point where we have like lots of ones and like lots of power. So this could cause interference. And how this is done is there's like something which is called hardware a linear feedback shift register, and then you have like a polynomial which you can apply, and this is like not a cryptographic randomization. It's just like trying to even out the zeros and ones. That's all it does. And we basically know the algorithm which is used, and the polynomial which the sender is used, also in the receiver, and it's just straightforward to reverse this effect, basically. Okay, but now we have looked into all the steps which are necessary, and now the question again is this also the case in reality? And I back to our data sheet from the Broadcom chip, we can see, maybe it's a little small, but like The first step, the frequency and time synchronization, is also part of this physical layer block here. Then we have a block which can be used for fast Fourier transformation. We have demodulation and the Viterbi, so basically the demapper, and the Viterbi decoder, which does the forward error correction. And then we need to descramble it. But in the end, we have bits which are ready for the MAC layer or the real-time core. Okay, speaking of real-time core, let's see what this is all about. So first, before so the real-time core, as I said, it takes care of everything which needs to happen quick, right? So and there is a specific problem which it tries to solve here is if multiple parties, like the example I showed at the very beginning with the Aloha net, if they actually send at the same time? And the answer is obviously no, because we have like a shared medium. And in contrast to Ethernet, what we can do in Ethernet is to first listen at the same time and then send if there's nothing going on. But in Wi-Fi, we cannot listen and send at the same time. So we need some kind of algorithm to fix this. And this algorithm, it needs to happen so fast that we like need this separate real-time handling of it. That's the main purpose of this real-time core. So to make this more, to show this a bit more, so this problem is called the hidden terminal problem. So let's go back to this Aloha net thing, which I explained at the beginning. So let's say I have like two islands, island A and island C. And island A is only the reception of island A is only so far, so it does not it's not received by island C and other way around. So C doesn't see A and other way around. But in the middle, I have, for example, my mainframe, and both of them see the mainframe, but they don't see each other, and that's the hidden terminal basically. For A, it can see B, but no C, and C can. And it's the same for B, right? So it cannot see A. And that's the hidden terminal problem. And that's why we can have these collisions. So how we can get rid of this? And what people came up with is called the distributed coordination function, DCF. And what's being done is basically, so here going back to this this diagram, so I have a sender, let's say A, and the receiver, let's say B. So a source and destination here. And before I do anything, I just wait a bit. So this is called the DCF in the framing space. So this is just a brief period of time. Every time I send something, the first thing I do is waiting. Then if this period is over, I send a ready-to-send packet to the destination. The destination also waits for a brief period of time and then says, okay, I think nothing is going on. Everything is clear, so it sends the clear to send back to the source. And then after another brief period of time, the source can actually send data to the destination, and at the end, the destination does acknowledge that it got the data and send that acknowledgement back. And then, only then, basically another source can send to the destination. And because the destination does basically sort of repeat this RTS sent by the source to everybody around it, so we can imagine that there is not only like island A, island B, but there's also island C, then basically island C can see, okay, there is something going on between A and B, I need to shut up. And that's how this is solved, basically. So this is also what I tried to write down here. So this waiting, so what also can be done is, let's say island C is the others here, it can, after the first ready to send was received, it can send an internal timer, because like all these times are pretty deterministic, right? So it knows, okay, and there is also even encoded how much data they want to send. So they can send the internal timer, and they know exactly like, how long it still takes till I'm allowed to send. And for example, this information can be used for power saving, so they can power down during this period of time, and then only after this next DIFS, they can start sending again. And to avoid that everybody is screaming at the same time again, there is also a random backoff added. And I can also update this time when I somehow receive the clear to send. And you might ask, okay, there's these two different types of waiting, like there's this DIFS and SIFS. And the reason for this is basically to have an implicit prioritization. So they always wanted to make sure that these controlled packets, the RTS, the CTS, and the acknowledgement, is always sent before the actual someone tries to send data again. And this way, because the SIFS is way shorter than the DIFS, so SIFS is like 10 to 16 microseconds, and DIFS is like 34 microseconds. And so like they try to have this, to use this as an implicit prioritization. And why even is there an, why do I even need this SIFS at the destination? This is mostly to give the transceiver some time to switch between sending and receiving. Okay, then the, let me speed up a bit. So the last part here is mainly the MAC layer. So actually this is the major part of where the firmware code is at. So the real-time core can just be like a simple state machine, but there's much complexity in the MAC layer. And because like at the end of this whole transmission thing, all you get at the end here is just Ethernet packets. So as was said during my introduction, the Wi-Fi chip does all the abstraction for you, and at the end you only get Ethernet packets. And therefore there needs to be like a lot of pre-processing which is done in the MAC layer. So what does this MAC layer do? It does frame aggregation and fragmentation. So let's say you have a very good channel, you can put more frames together and send them at once and also acknowledge them at once. If you have a very bad channel, you can try to split them up, send them individually. You need to do actual scanning, so where what access points are there even around me. Then if you have found one, you need to do some security and the association to this access point. Then there is power saving done in here. There's roaming, so let's say you want to switch between two different access points. This needs to be handled so that you don't lose connection in between. And there is also some checksums being done. So these, which kind of frames are handled during in the MAC layer? So we already saw that there is, when I explained the distributed coordination function, there are data frames and then there are these control frames. So the acknowledgement and the ready for send and clear to send. And what you see, and then there is also beacons, which are called, for example, beacons. There are other types of management frames, but the most relevant type of management frame is a beacon, which just is sent by the access point to say, hey, here I am, I'm on channel so and so, and my name is so and so. So, but for the actual data, which or for the things you see in the Linux driver, this is just basically the data frames. But maybe you say, okay, there still needs to be a way to send control messages to the driver, because I want to have it starting scanning and getting results back. And that's exactly right. So there is two different paths of how data is moved between the application or like the user space and the actual firmware. So one is used for data and the other one is for control frames. Or for not control frames, it's not, there are no frames exchanged. It's just a sort of an interface which is defined by CFG 802.11 in this case, which just says, okay, from experience we know that these functions a driver needs to provide. So and then the proprietary driver can implement these functions and they can be used by the upper layer software. So, but still, this is basically the sort of the control or management interface, and this is the actual data which is being exchanged. Okay, but maybe we want to get an open source firmware, And so as I said, this is all very proprietary. So for example, both the software running for the Wi-Fi core as well as the real-time core in the Broadcom case, this is just a binary blob. And maybe we want to reverse engineer this and have a sort of open source firmware. So which steps do we need to take care here? And I think this was even part of a previous talk. There was someone, Jasper, I believe, who talked about reverse engineering the ESP Wi-Fi firmware. And I figured these are all the steps which would be necessary in general to reverse engineer a Wi-Fi firmware and to create your own. So first step would be we need to figure out how is the hardware initialized, so which registers are written to at the beginning to set up the hardware. Then we also need some primitives to maybe you can just reuse some function at the beginning to send and receive packets. We need to figure out how can I run data in sort of tasks or processes because I don't want to congest the main loop all the time. How is the real-time part, like this distributed coordination function I explained earlier, how is this handled? Is this like more like I said, is this like a separate core or how is this working? And then we also maybe want to do some packet filtering. So we don't want to receive everybody's frames, but just the ones which are intended to be received by us. And in the end, we need to, if we want to make this upstream for the Linux kernel, we need to find a way to get this GPL license. And the only way there is basically is that the one who does the reverse engineering need to create a documentation. And this documentation need to be so good that someone else can implement working firmware from this documentation. This is called like a clean room implementation. And this is the only way you can do a GPL licensing. But this is maybe another topic. Okay, I think I have a few more minutes. I just want to show a brief demo because like I always ask myself, how does this IQ diagram look in reality? And how bad is it really to figure out where this cross is exactly and which bits are encoded by this? So what I have done is I have basically an old smartphone, which I was able to modify using a framework which is called Nexmon, which you can use to modify the firmware used by this Wi-Fi chip in this smartphone. And I just did a simple patch where I just sent out small data packets all the time. And then on the other side, on the receiving side, I have a FPGA board and an SDR chip, which is running Open Wi-Fi. Open Wi-Fi is a complete implementation of Wi-Fi, everything, the MAC layer, everything, and down to the real-time core. And you can change everything with Open Wi-Fi. Open Wi-Fi is great. And I have a notebook basically connected to this. And what we can do with this setup is seeing basically this equalization data I mentioned earlier. This is sent at the preamble. And if we take this correction data, we can basically plot the crosses and see how they look like. And so this is this I can show in a brief video. So what I did before we even start the video is I already started the sender, so that the smartphone does already start sending packets. And here we can see, I will just start the monitor mode to show you the packets really quick. And you can see that they are sent at a data rate of 24 megabits per second. You can see that at the bottom left, maybe. And this data rate means we need 16 crosses, basically, to encode the bits. After starting the sender, I can also start the receiver, the FPGA board, and then we get this nice sort of view. So just focus on the right-hand side. This is the actual constellation diagram, and this is me holding the smartphone. And as you can see, depending on how I hold the smartphone and just slightly change it, the points on the right hand side are already pretty disturbing. On it, it's like it's very difficult to figure out like what is like which of these points is supposed to be in which sort of sector. And yeah, this is just to give you a rough idea of how this actually looks like and how difficult it is for the Wi-Fi hardware to actually receive your data. Okay, that's all from my side. Yeah, thanks. I hope we have a few minutes for discussion.
Okay, wow, that was a lot of information. Thanks for the great talk. And we have time for a few short questions. So raise your hand.
Thank you for the great talk. Can you talk a little bit about different generations of Wi-Fi and what has improved in the processes that you talked about?
So, yeah, things only got more complex. So when I started back at this Nexmon project I mentioned, which I used to send the frames with this smartphone, right, I started with an 802.11b Wi-Fi chip, so a pretty old one. And the amount of firmware which is needed to do all the MAC layer stuff, it just got more and more complex. I think this is the only adjective I can imagine. So that the hardware gets more complex, the register interface it gets more complex. If you want to do any reverse engineering, I feel like it's easiest to start with a very old chip, try to get from there, and usually software is reused over the time. And then if you figure out how the old stuff is done, you know already parts of the newer stuff, and then you go from there, basically. I hope this answers the question.
Other questions?
Hi, thanks for the talk. Is there any good Wi-Fi chip with an open source firmware that you can recommend?
So there is no open source, completely open source firmware, there is none. So there is no proprietary chip which has a completely open source firmware. I think the Jasper with his ESP project is the first one to actually achieve this. But apart from this, there is this Nexmon framework where we try to provide a framework where you can reuse parts of the existing firmware to implement your own stuff. So this is there for Broadcom, and I also tried to write something similar for Extensa-based Qualcomm chips. But apart from that, there is no complete open source firmware. So the closest thing you can use is really this open Wi-Fi thing, but for this you always need a complete FPGA to do all the read time stuff, and then you need a really expensive SDR like this 809361 to get the IQ symbols basically. Then everything, so for open Wi-Fi, the whole FPGA implementation, everything is open source. But this is the only thing I'm aware of, and the ESP efforts by Jasper.
So about open source firmware for Wi-Fi chips, I thought that the Atheros Qualcomm, I think before Qualcomm, old chips, ATH9K were like that?
That's true, yeah. That's a really old SoftMac chip. So this means that the Mac layer was handled on the notebook, basically, and not on the chip. And therefore, it was easy to modify the Mac layer. But I have never looked into this, but I would assume that stuff like the distributed coordination function is still handled either in hardware or in like a small firmware blob inside the chip. But you're right, at least the Mac layer back for those chips was sort of open source because they did this. They offloaded it to the notebook and did not handle it on the chip itself, if that makes sense. Oh, there's one more.
There's one more question over there.
In the communication between the chip and the PC, is there some special protocol for this, or is it different for every chip?
It's different for every vendor, I would say. So, and even for maybe different generations of chips, it could be different. So, I recently looked into MediaTek. They are completely different than Broadcom. So it's basically always this control channel I mentioned back here between the driver and the firmware. This is always very different. This interface, of course, this is like standardized because of this CFG 800.11. This comes from this is defined by the Linux kernel, but down here this is completely proprietary. And in some cases they have some Even like the physical interface is different. So you can use SDIO, for example, to communicate with the Wi-Fi chip, so which is sort of like an interface used for MMC cards. There's PCIe I mentioned earlier, and then on top of this, there's also different implementations which are possible. So it's very different for different vendors.
Thank you for this intense lecture in the early morning. Did you find any of the hardware gadgets which have been handed out at CCC events useful for your analysis?
Sorry, say again, which hardware gadget? Oh, like...
Rocket and stuff.
I did not use any of those, but any SDR would be helpful, definitely. But it's like the major work is always reverse engineering the firmware itself and understanding the firmware. And it's like if you get so far that you can actually sense something, then an SDR gets really handy. But first of all, you need to understand the firmware and then you can continue. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks again to Daniel. And enjoy the rest of your day.